Well, hello and welcome to the next Patreon exclusive video, and forgive me for it being as late as it's been. And I want to tell you guys going into this, I'm going to do it a little bit different than I normally do, and you guys can be a sounding board and tell me if this is just like detracts from my contact or not, because I know my face is gorgeous, but I'm not really feeling... For those of you who follow me on Instagram or Twitter, you've probably seen me mention that my elbow's pretty messed up right now. My left elbow's got a lot of swelling. They say it's bursitis and a bone chip floating around. And I was expecting to get surgery, and I'm not getting surgery. And I can still move the thing and whatnot, but it hurts a lot. I'm on pain meds. I haven't slept good in days. And the script that I've got written for the Patreon exclusive video isn't the kind of... When I feel not so hot, I can put together something that's more of an opinion piece. It requires less research. This has got a lot of it's wordy, it's thoughtful. There is a lot of opinion, but there's a lot of other stuff too. So my point is I'm going to read this to you and narrate it and put images on the screen a lot, like a lot of other guys do, but it's something that I normally don't. So anyway, forgive the laziness aspect of it. I promise it's not because I'm lazy. It's because I absolutely know I'm not going to be able to remember two sentences when it's at all complicated right now. And there's a lot of words. So I apologize for that side of it. I apologize for taking as long as it is. Anyway, let's just jump straight on into this. You've waited long enough.
Archaeoastronomy is usually thought of as the alignment of buildings with stars or the sun, but it's really so much more than that. It's the study of how the ancients viewed the sky, how it mattered to them, and why. You've most likely heard me say something along the lines of archaeologists undervalue archaeoastronomy. Now, I can say that all I like, but I want to show you why it's important and some examples of how important it was for the ancient civilizations, and by the end of this, I think you'll know more about the subject and why I think it should be valued. Yeah, buddy. Sorry that I'm not on camera, but let's do this. Now, I'm going to ask a little more of you, as I assume that you're a little bit more knowledgeable than my average viewer, or at least a little bit more willing to entertain my shenanigans. Now, try to imagine yourself with no scientific knowledge at all. You're just basically like a baby, like you're just brand new to the universe, and you're viewing the world for the first time. Now, you would notice the sun pretty quickly, right? I mean, without it, life's cold and dark, and with it, life's alive, so it doesn't take long to figure that one out. And during the night, you would notice that the stars are beautiful and pretty amazing compared to anything you would see on Earth. And then it would take not very long at all for you to make some observations, and in a very short time, you could discern the north and south and east and west, and you would do all of that based on the stars and on the sun. And in a single lifetime, you could figure out that the seasons were connected to the sky, to the stars, and the position of the sun. And just in a few generations, with solstices and equinoxes and even more exacting concepts of stars comes into being, and you start seeing comets and eclipses. And by this point, the inherent perfection of the cosmos is evident. The stars and moon and sun, they all follow these hard patterns. And you can figure these patterns out with careful study. Now, this is before science, keep in mind, so this is kind of an amazing thing for early humans to recognize. This perfection, it was so apparent in the sky. I mean, think about the only straight lines you're going to see in nature in these days. They're going to come from, like, rays of light from the sun. I mean, the only real perfection you're going to see in nature is going to be up in the sky. And so, unsurprisingly, the sky's predictability became conflated with perfection, and this gave rise to all kinds of spiritual concepts. Now, complete cults of the sun themselves, that's kind of rare throughout history. But it does show up, and even in the cultures where the sun was not like the center of a cult, it was considered a source of power or a god. And this sort of sympathetic magic permeated the ancient world. Things that looked similar held similar power. An egg is more than a symbol of fertility, it's a talisman for fertility. The heart of a powerful beast didn't symbolically hold that animal's spirit, eating it imbued one with that animal's ferocity. Magic wasn't magic, it just was. And power, it was the coin of this stuff, man. I mean, some sources of power are more consistent than others, some were more perplexing than others, some were more useful than others. But out of all of those, the power of the sun, the stars, the moon, indisputably kings of reliability and usefulness. If you held the power to discern the sky, you knew the cardinal directions, you knew the seasons, you knew when the herds and the rains, and you basically were considered to grasp the unfathomable deep that is the cosmos. A person who took on a solar deity role, like a pharaoh, for example, now that's part of this tradition. They're taking the strength of the sun and labeling himself as the holder of that power. He made himself more than a man and more than a king. He was unchanging, never erring, perfect. He brought life, and this power he claims to have held, it works on the human psyche in a primal way. Ironically, it makes this imagined power very real in the sphere of human society. Now, Dr. Jane Goodall noted many things about the behavior of chimpanzees. So many of them, it's hard to remember them all. But one thing that was pertinent here is the reaction of dominant males to thunderstorms. Performing a ritualistic slow dance, they would emulate some connection to the storm, it seems, like acting like the power of the storm and they were connected, standing in the face of the thing and dancing with it. Similar behavior is seen when brush fires occur, a form of ritualistic movement and apparent attempt to communicate with the fire. Now, it doesn't take a lot of imagination to see this type of psychology evolving into a more elaborate set of ideas, still rooted in the power of these forces and their ability to be one with them. When a chip dances in the face of a storm, a pharaoh would be one with the sun itself. Both are trying to grasp this esoteric power they see in the sky, and both succeed in a weird manner through the social rewards they get for this behavior, despite it not having any real effects beyond that. It may just be a coincidence, but we still refer to the best and brightest among us as stars. And this brings us to the shamans themselves, the designers, you could say, of the individual group concepts of spirituality. These people were usually trained by their predecessors in magic, divination, communing with spirits, medicine, and herbs. And astronomy mingled with astrology in those days. Again, there was no separation between science and magic. These things were just as they were, and that's that. Now, all of their ceremonies were important. These were ways to commune with the spirit world. But the useful ones, the one with reliable power, these became more and more popular as time went on, kind of the Richard Dawkins meme hypothesis, right? Old school meme, not modern version of it. Herbal medicine and astronomy are ubiquitous as a result of this. Many cultures around the world have different ideas on which animals, trees, or rocks have which spiritual value, if any. But almost every culture watches the stars and uses plants for healing, because these were magics that worked. Most of these cultures that held these shamanistic beliefs had a three-tier system of existence. Sometimes they would have four, but it was usually the underworld associated with caves and water, the world that we live in, and then the heavens, obviously equated with the sky. Now, the underworld was generally thought to be a place of terror and death, and the land of the deceased, right? Know where you want to go, but you're stuck going. If you need me to explain this plane of existence to you, you may have eaten too many of the shaman's herbs, or you may be on the wrong channel. The heavens, now, they were a land of rebirth and perfection. Right? Rebirth on a fractal scale, the sun and the stars daily, the moon monthly, the sun's path yearly, the cycles of planets and comets and eclipses span centuries. The closer you look, the longer that culture watched and recorded, the more robust that idea became. So naturally, everybody wants to go there when they die. From the pharaohs we spoke of earlier to the lady on a church pew in your hometown, the land of perfection and rebirth is their end goal when they croak. Now, the people who could claim some connection to the powers of the sky, those people have garnered serious respect and even awe from their peers. Even today, a lot of people feel this way. So the shamans and others who have sought power from the sky, they had a prescribed means of getting this power. Following its movements was, of course, the foundation of this. From there, many different things became associated with the sky and its power. And different cultures, of course, have different ideas of it. Duh. But in many places, this knowledge, the power itself, became synonymous with royalty or stewardship of the land from a divine perspective. Basically, as humans got better at pulling that power from the sky and portraying it to others, the notions of god kings became more accepted. Somebody truly in touch with the universe. The king who is the sun, the person who is a god because they have the knowledge of the heavens at their disposal and know how to apply that to our world. Now, of course, sometimes it's backfired, a drought or a plague could see a god's king burnt on his own altar pretty quick, but most of the time this was a safe bet. You know the sky, use that knowledge to follow the herds and plants more effectively. You truly benefit your people. That's real power, and that power, well, that elevates not just your people, but you socially. When it comes to the power of the heavens being used to legitimize the ruling people, I'm not aware of a better example than China. When the Jesuit missionary Mario Ricci came to China to set up shop, he was amazed at how intertwined astronomy was with that ruling family. That his concept known as Shangdi, basically a divine mandate from heaven, basically this empowered the emperor and kept him in harmony with the universe, was the idea. And this was said to stem from a knowledge from the heavens, and as such, China had the largest body of official astronomers known in the world at that time. Marco Polo, when he went there, reported there were over 5,000 astrologers and soothsayers in China, and they were all using this equipment that blew Madio Rishi's mind when he saw it later on. The Chinese astronomers had gotten very skilled, but there was a sharp decline in skills by the time Rishi showed up in the 17th century. The Chinese day was 365.25 days as opposed to 365 days of Europe at the time, and they had a lot of records that were really accurate. With as many astronomers as they had, it seems a sort of culture of sameness took over, and innovations in astronomy became few and far between by the time Rishi showed up in Beijing. Rishi was an educated man, and he knew astronomy far better than most priests. So when he saw a myriad of different gadgets on the roof of the Royal Observatory, he knew that he was looking at a strong, deep tradition of stargazing and keeping painstaking records. He was said to be among the first men in the West to become fluent in writing Chinese. Rishi was so impressed by their art and music that he made maps and translated Portuguese to Chinese in dictionaries, and he was the first Westerner invited into the Forbidden City. He weaseled his way into getting that invite by predicting eclipses better than the Chinese astronomers could. His invite was the start of an appointment as the advisor for the emperor. And I say four and not two because he never actually met the emperor, but he was so well respected by the emperor that he was made an advisor nonetheless. Now this angle of astronomy was his new favorite thing. As a missionary, he had a way to directly prove his god's ability to harness the power from the sky was better than the emperor's. And the emperor's earthly power being based on that heavenly power, he was paying attention. So Rishi gained several converts, most of them mighty heroes of old, men of renown. I'm sorry, I had to. Popular and powerful men in China. But there is one aspect of this cultural exchange that is truly amazing. The Chinese observatory, it has rings of 360 degrees as well as 365 and a quarter that they used before the missionaries arrived. Despite having discerned a far more accurate year than the West's easier to use but less accurate 360-day year, they adopted it because they had adopted tons of European astronomy. Its ability to make more accurate predictions, the astronomy in general, not the 360-day year, gave Rishi and the church real-world power, so much that Rishi died in China, and when he did, the emperor himself made an exception to their laws about foreigners being buried in certain areas. He actually had a Buddhist temple set up to care for his remains, something that was extremely unusual at the time. And even after he had died, the power was affecting Rishi's mortal remains. Now, we can all see this is separate, calling it power that seems off to us. It's, you know, it's just a social response to inaccurate ideas about the cosmos, right? However, like the chimp staring into a storm or a pharaoh claiming the solar rays as his own, Rishi claimed real-world benefits from this astronomy. Now, maybe he didn't think he was harnessing power. Most likely he didn't. He was a learned man and he was a Christian. To him, it was probably just science. Simply measuring and recording until it became knowing. But to those who he interacted with, to those who were less science-minded and that he used to manipulate an angle, he was a powerful man due to his ability to discern patterns in the heavens. All right, now I've explained why and how the sky was important and how it was tapped for power. But how does all this help with research today? How can we use this to be more accurate in our education and we learn about the past? Well, let's a little bit of a case study here that we have good info on. This will allow us to kind of calibrate the ideas that I've got, if you follow me. Now, most ancient religious ideas can be separated into two metaphorical camps. You got hardware and software. Now, the hardware is what we usually end up with, be it a pyramid or a shield with the crescent moon and stars riveted to it. The things that we can touch is the hardware, right? The software would be the ideas behind it all. Which stars or planets, if any, were depicted on this shield? What light were these objects viewed in? How did they inform other aspects of their culture? What are these symbols? What should we expect to see when the power of these objects is invoked, when they think that they're really using these? More often, we lack this part when we look into an ancient belief system and we do it blind or nearly blind unless we have writings. And in this case, we do have some writings, the case that I'm going to bring up here, from relatively recently and some more contemporary people even right up until the modern day, although it's been corrupted a bit. So we do have a way to keep an idea as to how far off track we are here. So Kachinas are a Pueblo Native American spirit, one that's associated heavily with animism, the idea that everything has a spirit, right? We see as many different Kachinas as we see archetypes of nature. Kachinas for everything from rain to spirits meant to scare children into acting responsibly were believed to exist. Now today they're best known for the Hopi and their Kachina dolls. These dolls were originally intended to be a way to pass the knowledge of each Kachina down to the next generation. When the kachina ceremonies were performed, certain kachinas would be emulated by the people participating in the ceremony. They would dress accordingly and they'd dance like the kachina, and the dolls were a template, the way to pass this down to each generation and make sure they didn't stray off course. Now, about 100 years ago, the dolls became popular among collectors of indigenous artifacts, and this caused a resurgence of people manufacturing them, and this has caused a lot of innovations and stuff in the artwork style. And now a modern kachina doll doesn't really look like an original. The artistry is a lot more of the focus on a modern one, which makes sense. They're not being made for spiritual reasons anymore. They're being made to sell as art pieces. But anyway, some of the kachinas as spirit beings are supposed to have come from a Talawasuo, the fifth world. Directly translated, this means morning star, the planet Venus. Now, it's not associated directly with Venus, but that's like part of it, right? It's this esoteric land that we go to. They didn't expect us to get in a spaceship and fly there, so don't go all Anunnaki with me here. It was a spiritual place, but they identified it with Venus, much like the ancient Egyptians identified the Duat with their heaven, a spot in the sky. At any rate, there were other places too. There was an underworld that was often a place kachinas were supposed to originate from, and the colors associated with any of the individual kachina spirits was a clue to its personality and to its intentions. Now, the colors on a medicine wheel that so many of you are aware of reflect this, and it's also seen on the kachina directional altar of the Hopi. Now, this altar is an interesting cultural artifact that's still used today. Made of corn and other little fetishes, no, not those fetishes, laid out in an eight-direction pattern, a lot of times with one direction missing. Not that one direction. Quite obviously, this was set up, laid out by astronomical observations. And it seeks to commune with the kachinas by embodying heavenly power on Earth. Now, each ear of corn is a different color with this multifaceted symbolism that is rooted in the cosmology. Black corn, for example, was pointed north, the direction of the underworld, and the color of the kachinas, who were monstrous and scary, were also black. These colors varied from tribe to tribe, and even the Pueblo region that would differ, but the concept remained mostly the same. The sky was divided, and the earth was also divided along the same lines. The one was informed by the perfection of the other. This division was spiritual as well as physical, the two being indistinguishable, like I've said so many times now. Dividing the altar in this way invoked the power of the cosmos. It brought it to the earth. The order that the heavens project onto the earth into the ceremony. As a matter of fact, part of the ceremony is actually reflecting some of the sun's light from off of a piece of quartz into the bowl in the middle of that altar. Bringing the sun into that altar is definitely a solar astronomical ceremony. To them, this was real power, and it being the best magic around, the most useful, the most reliable, like I mentioned earlier, means that it's going to become quite possibly the most ubiquitous in a certain area, right? So we can look around the region and look for similar signs. These concentric rings designing their world view of that you see in the medicine circle that's associated with this altar. Those same yellow, black, white, and red being incorporated with the cardinal directions. You can look for those kinds of things. You can look for this Venus being part of the whole mess. There's a few things like that that get incorporated that you can see that you could potentially draw parallels with. Some of them more robust than others. For example, when we look at a tribal design like this one here, it certainly takes on a different meaning when you know what those colors mean in regards to a medicine wheel, right? And with designs like this one here. Now, all of a sudden, the idea that this may well represent the cosmos and cardinal direction seem reasonable, knowing what we just talked about. So when we see the Mayan calendar with its cardinal points clearly marked, and learn that their cosmology involved four colors for the four cardinal points, each of them with corresponding colors of corn and esoteric spiritual ideas and parts of the world and overworld and underworld associated with the colors, the idea that these cultures were involved in some sort of knowledge exchange when it came to astronomy gains a lot of traction, especially when we travel way up to the north and we see this sort of art from the Inuit people. We shouldn't be surprised to learn that these concentric rings represent different areas, the heavens, the sea, the land, the underworld. And again, we see those cardinal points being highlighted, those directions that are useful, that are practical, and that very much mark the world in a pattern emulating the heavens. So with this small but profound bit of information, we can look at the artwork of Indigenous Americans with a new set of eyes, and we're almost certain to find some things that we would not have seen otherwise. From patterns on pottery to the layout of a fire pit to the manner that a body was buried, this lens has the potential to offer new information. One, in my opinion, this is a lens that has not been used well enough in a long time, mostly because it's been associated with ideas of 12,000 BC and even in the early days of archaeoastronomy being accepted as a science, there was a lot of conflation with like the idea that these people were better engineers than were given credit for and whatnot. Like the Alexander Thom liked to conflate all kinds of goofy shit sometimes into his stuff and think that they went way further than it was. So it's always had a little bit of a woo label attached to it. I think that might have some of the problem. Also, another huge part of it is that astronomy and archaeology are very different disciplines. They are very, very different. You don't see a lot of archaeologists that are into astronomy and vice versa. There are some. Anyway, I'll babble a little bit more about that, but I'm not feeling the best in the world, so you get a little bit of rambling down there at the end. Sorry, I hope that's okay, guys. Thanks a lot for supporting me. I really appreciate it. Sorry that I did most of this off camera. That's not going to be a thing that I'm going to do much of, but every now and again, I think it makes life a lot easier, especially right now. We'll talk to you later. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you very much. I hope this was worth the wait. And again, I apologize for narrating it instead of staring at you with my gorgeous face. But I do appreciate you guys' support. I hope that you found that pretty intriguing. Honestly, I hope that'll help you out when we go forward into other videos, not just in Patreon exclusives, but on my channel proper. Kind of give you a little bit more insight into a lot of not just how I look at this stuff, but how the ancients looked at this stuff, right? There is a lot of there's a lot of stuff going on there. You see, this is why I had to sit down and narrate it. My brain is not 100% right now. They got me on all these dang freaking pain pills. All right, well, thank you very much. You guys have a great evening, and we will see you next time.